Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hello, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Diana Deeney.
And this is Greg Hutchins. Sometimes I go with a pseudonym, but today I'm just simply Greg. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you've been kind of busy in the ether, I've seen. You've had some webinars, you've had, you are publishing articles, you're talking a lot about AI stuff and where quality and reliability people fit in. And I've been monitoring some other things too, other industries, and seeing what they're thinking and feeling about it. And I wanted to kind of get your take about where the current status is of everything. Because I understand that you are looking at some of the higher level regulations or the non-regulation and seeing how countries are adopting or not adopting things. And I know that kind of has a trickle-down effect. But you also seem to have your finger on the pulse of what companies are doing, too. So I wanted to get your take on all this. So can we start with maybe, I don't know, the top down, like what are countries doing about AI and how that's affecting our jobs? Can you talk about that first?
So, yeah, a lot to talk about. So anyway, let's start with something a little bit more provocative. Okay, we don't want to be provocative. Let's say evocative.
Well, I'm good for either.
Yeah, okay. So there was an article just a couple of days ago where the headline was AI is going after your job.
Yeah.
Now, what prompted that? The head of AWS or Amazon basically said, and by the way, a lot of CEOs have been saying that lately, that AI is fundamentally going to change the future of work.
Yeah, there's been a lot of companies like they're like, we are now AI forward, meaning they want to focus more on the AI doing the jobs. Those are mostly software companies, right?
Well, so I'll give you an example of something that we used to lead on. And this is a true story. So for years, probably 20 some odd years, we would work with IEEE, electrical engineers, and basically do monthly seminars on the future of work and basically try to communicate to EEs and CS folks that you own your profession. And we'd lean with this hypothetical, with this case study. Let's say that you're a engineer, we'll say female engineer, graduating from Stanford, and you're 22. And your degree is in computer science. Now, remember, we did this 8 years ago, but the half-life of knowledge is 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Meaning, you know, for all of us techie types, or for us non-techie types who are listening, half-life of knowledge means that's the amount of time that knowledge in a discipline, field, or domain doubles. So let's say you're hypothetical, female, engineer, CS, Stanford, 4 years go by, you're 26 now, and you haven't retreaded, you haven't gone back to school, you haven't basically learned your discipline or upgraded yourself. So in the meantime, you're 26 and knowledge in this discipline of AI has doubled. Let's go through another cycle.
Mm-hmm.
4 years go by, you're 30, and knowledge in your domain has doubled again. So doubled when you're 26, it now doubles again when you're 30, and you haven't retreaded. You haven't gone back to school. You haven't learned much in AI. So you're 30, and knowledge in your field is has grown four times. Question that we would pose in our seminars with IEEE or with CS folks is, are you still employable, and why? Now I'll give you a story. This is a true story. We basically, a year ago, started coding, or we've been coding line by line. And we talked about this the other day,
uh-huh.
Line by line syntax. In 1 year, CS has gone from line by line coding to low code, no code, voice to app, which basically means that I tell a prompt what I want. Front end UI, back end database, state management, all that stuff. A library to bring in, the repos to bring in. And it can come up with code that is pretty darn good in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Something that would take us 2 weeks. So all of a sudden, the amount of knowledge in CS has basically quadrupled in 1 year. If you haven't retread it, or if you don't use those tools, are you still employable as a quality or reliability engineer? Are you?
As I don't know who said it. It was one of those blurbs on LinkedIn. Somebody was quoting a CEO from somewhere. I should have pegged it. But they said, you know, AI is not coming after your job. The people that use AI are coming after your job.
Boy, so what's the message there?
Yeah, I think it relates to that. Yeah, it relates to your story about the half-life of your knowledge and keeping up with the tools. But, you know, some of the problem or the challenge, I think, is understanding where you are in relationship to all the new things that are out there, because it sort of feels like the Wild West. Anything's possible and everybody's doing everything. And then also, so there's the technology aspect, just, you know, the capabilities of it for your job. And then the other part is how your company is adopting it, or how they want to adopt it, or if they're not at all, why? So I think for the practitioner, the quality and reliability engineering practitioner, those are big questions that kind of put a stop to running down the road of applying AI is not understanding your particular industry, where they're going with it, where your company is going with it, and just in general, the tools, you know, what's going to be available.
So we get a question every day, Diana, from engineers, non-engineers, about what should I do? And we get so many of these that I'm thinking, shucks, maybe we should develop an AI literacy practice. Because, again, I'm an AI boomer. We have two types of folks out there, AI
okay.
boomers and AI doomers. And I'm
right.
an AI boomer. You know, I want to make money. And that's the reason why I wrote this article for Quality Magazine called Show Me the Money. And we'll talk about that in the next session, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
The opportunities are. But here's what's happening. Folks call me, email me every day. What should I do? And I've responded to a person, a woman, who was a non-techie. She was very smart, had a great degree, but here she was as a manager and was really trying to figure out what to do. And of course, her company, and I'm not going to mention the company, I didn't know anything about it. But what I did are two things that all of us should do who are working with a company. And this is what I did. I went to ChatGPT and I prompted, what's the culture and politics in this company?
Yes, okay, yeah, no, I'm on board.
And
yes.
Then basically I did a second prompt, what's the culture and politics around AI in this company? And then basically I posed the question, the third question I posed is, how do I develop knowledge and gravitas in AI to make a difference, a value-added difference in that company?
So because did he, did, yeah, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the third question is really, what's the value-added differentiator or value-added component that I as an individual can make in this political environment? Because the reality is, every CEO is going to be hammering, we're AI first.
Yeah.
And us individuals in the company have to do something that will communicate either real or perceived. What's our value that we're giving in this AI-first company? So I'd recommend those three things if you're wondering what to do in this morass or jungle of conflicting messages. And I get it. We're all fearful of this new technology. We don't know what to do. We don't even know where to start.
So now you queried about the culture of a company on ChatGPT, and it's pulling from the internet. So I'm assuming that it was pulling all the official announcements and news articles and that kind of thing, maybe financial reports that the company would give. So I know a lot of companies, and especially when you get down into department level stuff, people don't share that publicly, like their initiatives or the things that they're working on. So I would think that's really interesting that you started with an AI to ask those questions. So that kind of gives you the public facing answer. But then there might be internal things that are going on within the company that aren't apparent to the public because it's proprietary, or maybe it's an R&D and they're trying it out. So when you were talking with that woman and she didn't know what to do, and you did this exercise with her, did that kind of line up with what she was seeing? Did that help her at least pick a direction to start to evaluate whether she wanted to go down that road or not?
So, you know, I shared with you some of the tricks and tools that we use in trying to train people or making them aware of keeping current and making ourselves valuable. This is another thing that I do. Whether you're an individual contributor, middle manager, or an officer in the company, read your 10-Ks and your 10-Qs. Those are the SEC financial statements. They actually distill the internal dialogue that's going on in the company. Every publicly held company, everyone around the world, whether it's NASDAQ, NYSE, or London Stock Exchange, has an equivalent. Again, the two fiduciary responsibilities they have are public disclosure, transparency, and they have to disclose. They have to disclose their risks. That basically means disclosing their fears.
Yeah,
what
okay.
could happen. If you look at a financial these days, 1/3 of the entire financials are risks, page after page after page after page of disclosures. They have to be transparent. That is the internal and public-facing dialogue that they have. Dialogue meaning internal and external dialogue that they have with investors.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. The machines are able to pick that up and give you the politics. Now, most of us engineers, and I guess I'm one, I've been one many years, we don't like to talk politics. But in these days of change, of fear, it's very, very important for us to understand what's going on, because your manager, your director won't tell you.
Yeah. So all that information is there, and it's not normally something as engineers that we look at. Even if we are, you know, really invested, if we are managing people and are invested in the company, I don't know that many of us really look at that stuff in the companies that we're working for. So that's some good insight to use these AI tools to investigate just the pulse of our company from a different viewpoint, from a operational viewpoint that maybe we're not looking at. It could fill a blind spot, right?
Well, there's a famous quote that culture eats strategy for lunch. I don't know who said it, but anyway, that's it. That's the reason why I pose the issue of culture in an organization. Most of us engineers are, you know, hugely smart in terms of IQ. Okay, we're Mensa type people. But we're hugely inadequate in terms of understanding and working with culture. So our EQ is Densa, our IQ is Mensa. And we, in this time of what I would call explosive disruptive change, have to become much more adapt and adept and adopt the politics, understand the politics of the organization. Because AI, especially if it's being pushed by the board, a customer, or our boss, is going to be political in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And we have to fit ourselves as a value contributor in that messaging, AI messaging.
And I bet you mentioned that those reports, they list a lot of risks. And I'm sure there's a lot of AI risks that are listed there. You're shaking your head, yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've probably heard this thing. I'm a one-trick pony these days. It's risk, risk, risk. Why? Because we live in a world of disruption. AI is disruption. The filter, the lens for understanding disruption is risk. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, I dealt with that in my roles in companies too, with risk and stuff. And it's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it. sort of like when you go to engineering school and you learn to be an engineer, it just trains you to think in a certain way. So once you start analyzing things by risk, using risk-based decisions and helping other people to do that too, it's really hard to not do that. It's hard to unsee that. Would you, and is that why you think everything comes back to risk for you?
Well, aside from being a one-trick pony, right? It's like, okay, I'll jump through this risk hoop and everything is a risk type of problem.
Well, I don't know about that, but...
Well, yeah, that's good. We differ on something. I think that in these days where AI is becoming much more prevalent and the messaging is changing, and again, it's a fear message. I mean, I hate it these days because we weren't trained to deal with instability or volatility or, you know, that type of stuff. We were trained to deal with complexity and our engineering problem solving, but we weren't basically trained to deal with lots of external externalities that are, you know, uncertain. And we have to these days. Why? Because we have to. We're dealing with our differentiators. Traditionally, as engineers, used to be the value-added differentiators is what the expression is. Used to be our knowledge. We could solve a halt. We could solve a FEMA. We could solve this problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now the machine can do it in a nanosecond. So what value do we have now? The value is going to be in our risk-based decision-making and our risk-based problem-solving under uncertain conditions. So we have to learn a new alphabet, a new way of approaching stuff.
And I think, too, the engineers that have been around learned code line by line, learned how to do, you know, things the hard way. There's a baseline knowledge there that, you know, I kind of equate it to some of the statistical software that came out in the 80s, 90s, that it used to be really hard to do statistics until there was software for it.
Then
once there was software for it, it became more democratized. A lot more people could use it. But you had to understand the fundamentals in order to use it right. So I'm seeing a lot of these tools that yes, we were trained in a certain way to think and with knowledge. But with that knowledge comes a lot of power in order to be able to use these new tools properly. So we can, you know, run finite element analysis. Anybody can do it. I remember when not everybody could do it. We used to have to farm it out to somebody that had a computer that was strong enough to be able to handle it and that they were knew enough about coding and finite element analysis programming to be able to program the machine. Well, now it's not like that anymore. Now it's more available to more people. But you still need to understand the basics of material failure and materials themselves and different stresses, some computer coding. So I think that knowledge that we've been gaining is just sort of comes to a head where we can decide what we need to do, when we need to do it, and that it just, the AI tools are supplementing those ideas and making it easier.
If I hear you properly, Diana, our value contribution is in the decision-making abilities that we have.
Yes. You just summarized my, 2-minute rant in one phrase.
No. It's never a rant from you, Diana. It's words of wisdom, you know, coming from the heavens, right? You know,
yeah. I'll tell my family that.
Oh, yeah. I'm on bended knee when I listen to you, you know.
So this is a current state where we are right now, right? Yep, with things. It's so interesting. But we were going to wrap up this episode Did you have any other like last minute things you wanted to add about the current state?
The only thing I would probably, and we could put this in the show notes, let's put a little tap into the talk that I gave on AI literacy. And I guess people get an idea of what's going on. And then check out the Quality Magazine article coming out next month. Show me the money. A lot of us are fearful. It's change coming down the road. If we hunker down and do nothing, that's a decision.
Yeah.
It's meaning we're risk averse. Again, there's one trick pony, right? If we want to be risk taking and see the opportunity, we're going to be a risk boomer. Show me the money.
Yeah. Well, if you are listening and you're sitting as a quality reliability engineer in your company and not sure what to do with all these AI initiatives, I think Greg gave you some tips that you could use to start investigating, the culture of your company, where things are heading for that. And it uses the very tool that's disrupting everything. So use it to your advantage to learn a little bit more about your current situation so you can make a decision. And that could be deciding not to do anything. That, like you just said, that is a decision. So if you're listening, where are you with your AI adoption? Is it something you're excited about? Are you spearheading it in your company? Are you not really sure what to do with it? Send us a message at the Speaking of Reliability. I think it's AscendoReliability/SOR. You can leave a comment. And as always, Greg and me and the other hosts of the show are on Ascendo Reliability, and you can find us through there and on LinkedIn. Well, Greg, it's been eye-opening and a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay. Well, my only last tip is be an AI boomer, not a doomer.
Yeah.
Show me the money.
Thanks, Greg.
All righty. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.